This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Greetings to you and welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. On today's program, we're going to talk about leadership. This world's leaders are making some extraordinary decisions that are completely upending the lives of billions of people. In so many cases, they're pronouncing edicts and making laws and policies and governing according to their whim and will, yet not even obeying their own policies. They're hypocritically demanding things of the people that they won't even follow themselves. In other cases, you have leaders taking a much more balanced and measured approach and preserving rights and freedoms for people that make life much more pleasant. These times vividly illustrate what a difference leadership makes. We're going to talk about a key quality of leadership that is dangerously lacking in most leaders today. This is a profound principle, and it's a lesson we can take from recent events that gives us insight into God's thinking and godly leadership. And it's a lesson we can even apply in our personal lives. Before that, though, we'll start with a report on Germany. Today is Chancellor Angela Merkel's last day on the job after nearly 16 years. This is the end of an era for her nation. We'll look back on the legacy of this extraordinary woman who's led Germany through some very challenging times, crises like economic catastrophes in Cyprus and Greece, a flood of Islamic immigration from Syria. Merkel has managed these crises for better or worse. And in the meantime, she's strengthened Germany's economic, political, and military position within Europe. That is very evident. And she's strengthened Germany's economic, political, and military position within Europe. That's very evident to everyone. But her tenure has also been marked by increasing domestic instability. And it opens the door for the fulfillment of one of the most important end time prophecies in the Bible. So let's begin here by surveying the career and the legacy of this longtime German leader in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
On September 23rd, Germans voted to select a replacement for their longtime Chancellor Angela Merkel. The queen of German politics for over 16 years, she is Germany's second longest serving chancellor since World War II, beaten only by her mentor, Helmut Kohl. She was replaced today by the Social Democratic Party leader, Olaf Scholz. She's been called the most powerful woman in the world, the de facto leader of the European Union, and even the leader of the free world. Her biographer, Matthew Quartrup, called her the uncrowned queen of Europe. She was the most senior leader of the G7 and ruled the EU's largest economy. She's also the first chancellor of a reunited Germany from the former East Germany. Her chancellorship was historic in many different ways. Now that she's left, it's worth looking at her legacy to see where she brought Germany and Europe. After all, the Germany Mr. Scholz will inherit is largely a product of the Merkel era. Angela Dorothea Kastner was born on July 17, 1954 in Hamburg, West Germany. Her father, Horst Kastner, was a Protestant minister who accepted a pastorate in Brandenburg, East Germany. When she grew up, she moved to the eastern city of Leipzig to go to university. It was there where she married her first husband, Ulrich Merkel, in 1977. They divorced in 1982, but she kept his last name. East Germany entered into turmoil at the close of the 20th century. The Berlin Wall, dividing Germany's historical capital in two, came tumbling down in 1989. East Germans could now travel freely to the West. It was clear that it wouldn't be long before the communist regime fell with its wall into oblivion. Merkel was at the forefront of East Germany's transition to democracy. As the communists were losing power, she joined the Democratic Awakening Party. The party won only 0.9% of the votes in the 1990 parliamentary elections in East Germany, but it still became a coalition member of the government. East Germany's Christian Democratic Union, or CDU, sister party to the West German CDU, leaded the coalition under Lothar de Maizière. Merkel became his deputy spokesperson. She joined the CDU later that year. A few months later, the Eastern and Western CDU parties merged. On October 2nd, Germany was reunified. She won a seat in Germany's Bundestag, or parliament, in the December 1990 elections. Helmut Kohl, first chancellor of a reunified Germany, gave her a cabinet position. Kohl became Merkel's mentor. The bond between them was so close, Kohl referred to Merkel as his girl. Kohl lost re-election in 1998 to Gerhard Schröder of the Social Democratic Party, or SPD. While this meant Merkel would be out of government, it was actually her opportunity to seize. In November of that year, she was elected CDU Secretary General, a senior party position. In 2000, she would become party leader. The CDU won the 2005 federal elections 1 percentage point over the Social Democrats. But upon Schröder's resignation as chancellor, Merkel was able to put together a grand coalition between the CDU and the Social Democrats. Angela Merkel made history and became Germany's first woman chancellor. In some ways, her first project as chancellor was started by her predecessor. After he lost the 2005 election, but before he had formally left office, Schröder signed the Nord Stream agreement with the Russian government. This paved the way for the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to be constructed. Nord Stream 1 is a natural gas pipeline that runs from Russia's Baltic coast under the ocean before surfacing in Germany. The pipeline was and is controversial because of its implications for European security. Most of Russia's fossil fuel pipelines travel through countries like Ukraine and Poland, countries terrified of a Russian invasion. Fossil fuels, however, are such a major export for Russia that Moscow couldn't meddle in those countries too much without ruining its economy. Nord Stream 1 was a step in allowing Russia to export natural gas to energy-hungry Western Europe while bypassing Eastern Europe. Nord Stream 1 was completed in 2012. In 2014, Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine. In 2016, construction began of the project's second phase, Nord Stream 2. This would be a pipeline running parallel to Nord Stream 1, doubling Russia's gas exports. As of today, Nord Stream 2 has been completed and is waiting on regulatory approval to begin pumping gas. Annalena Baerbock, Scholz's foreign minister, is a vocal opponent of the pipeline. We'll see what happens with the pipeline in the days to come. Germany had another federal election in 2009. The CDU increased its share of the votes and could make a coalition with the Free Democratic Party, a classically liberal, business-friendly party. An accomplishment of her second term in office was her phasing conscription out of the German military, or Bundeswehr. The Bundeswehr was founded in 1955 as the West German military. For almost all of its history, it has been conscription-based. This changed in 2011. Merkel's defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, scrapped conscription and instead brought in a professional army. This may seem rather innocuous, but becoming a professional military meant more than just changing how the Bundeswehr got its soldiers. When rebuilding Germany, one of the reasons the Allies of World War II wanted the military to be conscription-based was to make it a citizen military. A group of German citizens with different political views and party allegiances forced together wouldn't be as coherent a fighting force. It would mean the military's composition would be constantly in flux. This would theoretically stop the military from becoming its own state within a state, like it was for most of German history. The post-2011 Bundeswehr is no longer a citizen army propped up to face a Soviet invasion. It's now a force made up of men and women who joined the armed forces because they wanted to. It's a professionally funded, professionally trained group in it for the long haul. And it's a more effective fighting force because of it. Berlin has used its new professional military and wars in the Middle East and West Africa. One of the longest-lasting issues that Merkel has had to deal with as Chancellor is the European debt crisis. Being the EU's largest economy put Germany at loggerheads with many cash-strapped countries. Germany wasn't hit too hard by the 2008 Great Recession, but that can't be said about every country in Europe. Certain Mediterranean countries had their economies close to collapse in the years following. At the end of Merkel's second term, one of those countries was Cyprus. Cyprus's banking system went into meltdown, and the government didn't have enough money to bail them out. Merkel's Germany stepped in. She offered Cyprus the equivalent of $13 billion. In exchange, Germany could help itself to the savings of Cypriots. German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble told Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiades what the terms of the deal would be. Anastasiades would have to confiscate 7 billion euros, or $9.3 billion in 2013 values, from his own citizens' bank accounts. Greece's economy fell at the same time as Cyprus's. Merkel's Germany had an integral role in fixing the Greek crisis. In 2015, Syriza, an outsider radical leftist party, won Greece's parliamentary elections. Tired of the overbearing financial regulations put on Greece in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis, and the previous Greek government's compliance with those regulations, new Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras picked a fight with the rest of Europe. Merkel's Germany was one of the main targets of Syriza's wrath. The German Chancellor, however, was the wrong person for Syriza to pick a fight with. Merkel ended up being one of the main negotiators between Athens and Brussels. Berlin and Brussels twisted Athens' arm. They threatened to let Greece freefall out of the euro if need be. Under the deal the Greek government adopted, as negotiated by Angela Merkel, the EU had veto power over new Greek laws and could force Greeks to repeal existing laws. And this was overriding a democratic referendum where Greeks voted to reject a previous bailout package organized by the EU, which was the basis of the one the Greek government adopted. Syriza may or may not have deserved what they got from all the ultimatums they issued to Brussels, but this is still an example of Germany using the EU to diminish the sovereignty of a fellow member state. Greece and Cyprus were the only Mediterranean countries to catch Merkel's attention. Syria had been stuck in a civil war since 2011. The chaos forced millions of Syrians to flee north in search of a better life. For many of those Syrians, their final intended destination was the EU's most prosperous state, Germany. Having hundreds of thousands of impoverished Middle Eastern migrants arriving into one's country, migrants who can't speak German and haven't been vetted for terrorism links, would obviously have put many Germans on edge. What was going to be Merkel's response to all of this? Wir schaffen das, or we can do this. 6 years on, has Germany been able to do this? Since 2015, Germany has accepted roughly 1 million refugees and migrants. About half of that number are refugees from Syria. Many have integrated into German society, but many also haven't. A July 2021 report from InfoMigrants suggests that roughly two-thirds of Syrians who are able to work rely fully or partially on welfare to make ends meet. This contrasts with 37% of Somali migrants and 44% of Afghan migrants who are dependent on welfare. Only about 27% of Syrians in Germany are of working age. The influx of migrants, and not just those from Syria, brought an increase in Islamist terror attacks in Germany. Germany fared a lot better than some other countries like France, but that doesn't make the impact of these terror attacks any less painful. Major German cities like Berlin, Munich, Hamburg, and Würzburg have all had to deal with deadly terror attacks. This has predictably caused a surge of the far right in Germany. The Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD party, was founded only in 2013. It originally was organized as a Eurosceptic anti-immigrant party, but since its founding, it has become an anti-Semitic party that supports the rehabilitation of Germany's Nazi legacy. In the 2017 parliamentary elections, it became the third largest party in the Bundestag. The CDU and the SPD formed another grand coalition, which made the AfD the largest opposition party. The far left has also thrived during the Merkel era. Die Linke, the successor to East Germany's Socialist Unity Party, got 9.2% of the vote in 2017. Die Linke is the most popular in former East Germany. They currently head government in the eastern state of Thuringia. Under Merkel, Germany has experienced political polarization and extremism that it hasn't seen since the fall of the Weimar Republic in the 1930s. Yet, even as crises were rocking Germany domestically, Merkel was building an empire. Axing conscription wasn't the only reform Merkel gave to the Bundeswehr. Under Gutenberg's replacement as defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, the Bundeswehr systematically swallowed the armies of its neighbors. In World War II, this was done through panzer tanks and blitzkrieg. This time, von der Leyen accomplished this through negotiations and mutual agreements. For example, in March of 2016, the Dutch 43rd Mechanized Brigade joined the Bundeswehr. This meant that two-thirds of the Dutch army's command structure would be controlled by Berlin. In February of 2017, the Czech Republic and Romania agreed to integrate some of their brigades into the Bundeswehr. That same month, von der Leyen signed a declaration with the Belgian and Norwegian defense ministers, showing their intent to join a Dutch-Luxembourgish fleet of refueling aircraft. In April of that year, France and Germany agreed to jointly operate a transport aircraft fleet. Von der Leyen became president of the European Commission, the EU's executive head, in 2019. She's now using her experience of synchronizing militaries on the European level. One of the most important trends the Trumpet has watched for over the years is the emergence of a strong German leader to take control of Europe. We base our analysis on several biblical prophecies. Revelation 17 prophesies of seven empires arising in Europe to resurrect the conquests of the old Roman Empire. The last of these culminated in Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. This was the sixth resurrection. That means one more is due to come from Europe. Isaiah 10, meanwhile, prophesies of the Assyrians, Germany's ancient ancestors, being the main people to resurrect this empire in an attack against America and Britain. The book of Daniel prophesies of the leader of this German-dominated Europe. He will be extremely intelligent, one who understands riddles. He will have a lot of power. He will appear as a man of peace, but will command a formidable war machine. His military will destroy rival powers almost effortlessly. We don't expect this man to be Olaf Scholz, but we expect this man to be coming on the scene soon. How soon exactly remains to be seen. How does Angela Merkel fit into this? Nobody is accusing Merkel of being a closet Nazi. Nobody is accusing her of being the mastermind behind turning the EU into a totalitarian, globe-encompassing superpower. She is not the figure mentioned in the Book of Daniel. But she prepared Germany and Europe for him. Before Merkel became chancellor, Germany was certainly a powerful country. But you couldn't really call it the uncrowned king of Europe. The German chancellor wasn't considered the leader of the free world. But Merkel has done all she could to turn Germany into Europe's most powerful nation. Her treatment of Cyprus, of Greece, showed Europe Germany isn't afraid to twist smaller countries' arms. The military agreements she signed with other European states are making Germany the nucleus of an EU military. Merkel led the way for Germany's Bundeswehr to become world-class by making it professional. And her approval of Schroeder's Nord Stream project shows she isn't afraid to do a deal with Russia that puts Eastern Europe at a security risk. A security risk that makes Europe more energy dependent on Germany. Yet Merkel's chancellorship has also been marked by an increasing instability domestically. Her botched handling of the Syrian refugee crisis and the spate of Islamist terror attacks that followed it caused many to be disillusioned with the government. Many began looking to extremist parties like the AfD and Die Linke. This culminated in the 2017 election, where for the first time since World War II, a far-right party became the largest group in opposition. Germany has become more politically unstable than it's ever been since 1945. Germans are looking for somebody that can pull them out of the problems that have accumulated in the Merkel era. Problems like the debt crisis, the refugee crisis, the increase in Islamic terrorism, and the political polarization. But when Germans find their man, he's going to inherit a Germany bigger and badder than it was in 2005. It's a Germany that's ready to take the world by storm. And Germany under this man will do just that. Thanks to Merkel's 16 years in office, Germany and Europe is ready for him. To learn more, please request a free copy of Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, available at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Here is a morsel of wisdom, a biblical proverb that has special relevance in today's world. Proverbs 29 and verse 2 says, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked bear rule, the people mourn." What a difference a leader can make. When righteous men rule, the lives of the people are so much better. Evildoers are punished and restrained. People are freer and more prosperous. When wicked are in authority, freedoms are curtailed. Rights are stripped from people. Corruption spreads. Taxes increase. Wealth is confiscated. Evil goes unpunished. Good people are oppressed. We're really seeing the truth in this proverb today. This is a proverb about government. It's really about God's government versus Satan's government. And the world we live in proves how Satan's government produces a lot of mourning. We're suffering under leaders and officials who are pronouncing edicts, governing however they want, in so many cases, not even obeying their own policies, just demanding things of people that they won't do themselves. They're very arrogant, very sure of themselves, and very brazenly anti-God. We're getting a good look at the problems that happen when the wicked bear rule. I want to talk about the most fundamental quality of good leadership that these leaders lack. This world desperately needs new government. It needs godly leaders. And God wants to help turn the mourning of today into rejoicing. He wants to put leaders into office, and he wants to build leaders by instilling within them this fundamental quality that we're going to talk about. This quality results in an entirely different and revolutionary type of leadership. What is it? Well, let's begin by hearing the words of one of the greatest leaders of all time, really. He was a leader in the ancient nation of Israel, King David. This man learned profound lessons in godly leadership in his lifetime. And this is his charge to his own son about leadership. You can read it in 2 Samuel chapter 23. "Now these be the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, said, and the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, 'The Spirit of the Eternal spoke by me, and his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, he that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God.'" Now think about this. If you're in a position of leadership, if you're a parent or a teacher or a supervisor, a manager, employer, or in any other position of leadership over other people, according to this great man, you must be just. That means lawful and righteous. A godly leader keeps God's law. He conducts himself at a godly standard, but also he seeks justice for others. He ensures that they receive justice. And you must rule in the fear of God. Now, this is the fundamental quality that we're going to focus on. This really is profound. He that rules over men absolutely must rule in the fear of God. He has to recognize that God is the real authority, that he is under God, under the rule of the Almighty God, that he is accountable before God for how he uses the authority delegated to him. A leader who lacks that fear is going to make terrible mistakes. And this is the quality that is lacking in so many of the leaders of this world. I would say almost across the board, they do not have the fear of God. They are accountable to no one but themselves. So they get into all kinds of abuses of power. And this is the cause of so many of the problems in the world today. And just to finish the thought here in 2 Samuel 23, he that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. It says, and he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun rises, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springs out of the earth by clear shining after rain. That's talking about what a blessing it is to be led by people who are just and who rule in the fear of God. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked bear rule, the people mourn. You can go back to the beginning of human history in the book of Genesis. And Genesis 3 actually explains the foundation of the present world, the world as it is today. That was Adam, the very first man, eating from the tree of death, eating from the tree that God explicitly commanded him not to eat from. Now, this is what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote in Mystery of the Ages. Adam, the first human, rejected knowledge from and reliance on God. He chose to rely on his own knowledge and abilities. The modern world developed from Adam relies wholly on human self-reliance. The psychology taught in our day is self-reliance. Rely on the innate powers within you, they teach. An atmosphere of self-reliant professionalism pervades most modern university campuses. It is the spirit of vanity. Now, if you just think about the leaders who are ruling today, how their thinking is absolutely saturated with that kind of self-reliance. Whatever problem they encounter, they approach it with their own reasoning, and they are heedless of the problems caused by that kind of approach. Now, that attitude comes directly from the devil. Satan was the one who inspired that attitude within Adam and Eve. You can read that there in Genesis 3, and he inspires it within the whole world. Within a leader who lacks the fear of God, the devil can really have a great deal of influence. Satan was the one who said, you can read this in Isaiah 14, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will be the Most High, I will be as God, I will be God. That's the way the devil thinks, and that's the lie that he told to Eve. He told her, you will be as God. That spirit of self-reliance and vanity is the opposite of what God needs in a leader. Jesus Christ himself has 180 degrees total opposite of that thinking. He said when he was on earth, I can of my own self do nothing. This man had been the second most powerful being ever in the universe, and yet he had total humility, total reliance on God. And you can even see in Hebrews 5 and verse 7 that he had godly fear. He has proper reverence and respect for God the Father. He rules in the fear of God. He is perfectly under his Father's authority at all times. He says, I do nothing of myself, but only what I see my Father do. I speak only what I'm commanded to speak. He rules in the fear of God. Now, that's the attitude that God needs in a leader, and that the more a leader has that attitude, the more successful he'll be, and the more that people rejoice under his leadership. God built his chosen nation, Israel, on the foundation of that attitude right from the beginning. He led through Moses. Moses was the meekest man on earth. He was very obedient to God. When Moses needed help, then God inspired a system of governmental organization based on this council. You can read it in Exodus 18. Hearken now to my voice, and I will give you counsel. God shall be with you. Be you for the people to Godward, and you may bring the causes unto God, and you shall teach them ordinances and laws, and shall show them the way wherein they must walk and the work that they must do. This is Moses' father-in-law speaking to him. A godly leader has to govern according to the law of God. But then he talks about how to raise up other leaders. Moreover, you shall provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and put them into positions of power and authority. Now, this is outstanding counsel. He describes four qualities here. He says they have to be able, they have to be capable and competent, they have to be honest and truthful, they shouldn't be greedy and susceptible to corruption, but they must be men who fear God. A leader who rules properly must be humble enough to clearly see God. He must be under the authority of God and taking direction from God. That's really the only way that government can work. God's government has one man at the top who fears God, and everyone under him administers the same government because they all fear God. God is always in the picture. You can read Moses' account later, looking back on how that government was implemented, and this is in the book of Deuteronomy, and he's giving a few interesting details here. He says, "And I spoke to you," he's speaking to the people of Israel at that time, saying, "I'm not able to bear you myself alone. The Eternal has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day as the stars of heaven for multitude." Now, he was acting as God's sole representative, administering God's government, but the job was too big for him. So then he explains how that was corrected. He said, "So I took the chief of your tribes, wise men and known, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands, and captains over hundreds, and captains over fifties, and captains over tens, and officers among your tribes." And then he instructed them on how to lead. "And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brothers and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him." He told them, he that rules over men must be just. You have to judge righteously and justly. And then he said, "You shall not respect persons in judgment, but you shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's." The judgment is God's. A godly leader is administering God's authority. He's carrying out God's wishes. He can't be a people pleaser. He must be a God pleaser. Seeking God's will is the most important point in godly leadership. That's really ruling in the fear of God, trying to rule just as God wants, exercising authority as close as possible to how God himself would exercise it. Now, this is very practical. We need to recognize this in our families, with our own children. We're administering God's authority in their lives. They're not ours to do with as we please. They're God's. We're accountable before God in how we rear them. We have to be just, ruling in the fear of God. You know, if a man doesn't do what he believes is right for his family because he's afraid of how his wife will react or his children will react, he's not using his authority properly. He's ruling in the fear of a woman, or he's ruling in the fear of a child rather than ruling in the fear of God. And as Moses said here, you shall not be afraid of the face of a man or a woman or a teenager, for the judgment is God's. Now, to have that kind of fear of God totally changes the way that you exercise authority. Today, you have these school boards and administrators who are stripping authority from parents, and they're forcing radical Marxist ideas on these students. And you have parents who are speaking out, but they're being bullied and they're being silenced, and the government is considering them domestic terrorists because they do not fear God. They are not accountable to God. They feel like they are the highest authority, and anyone who would challenge their authority, even the parents of the students that they teach, that they should be silenced. Now, this shows you how fiercely we need to fight for our families. You, if you are a parent, you have to fight for your children. You have to fear God more than you fear the state, and you have to do whatever you need to protect your children, because you're accountable to God for the way those children are raised. And these officials do not fear God. They're acting in their own interests. They're exercising authority however they please. They're accountable to no one, and you can see how dangerous that is. Now, one other law that you can look at, the laws that God gave to Israel's monarchy, you can see them in Deuteronomy 17, and it talks about how God is to choose the king, and God commands that he not trust in his military. And then he talks about his concern for the character of the ruler. He says that he shall not multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. A leader's heart should be turned to God, not led astray by lust for women or for riches. Those are problems that destroy kings. And when they destroy kings, they destroy nations. And then in verse 18 here in Deuteronomy 17, it says, "And it shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life." He must be a diligent student of God's law. And what is the first and most important reason this gives for that? It says that he may learn to fear the Eternal, his God, and to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them. He has to learn to fear God. And the right kind of fear leads to obedience to God. Fearing God is something we learn. It's something that takes time and it takes study. This is a comment from Matthew Henry's commentary about this verse, that this daily study of God's law must possess this king with a very reverent regard to the divine majesty and authority. He must learn to fear the Lord his God, and as high as he is, he must remember that God is above him. And whatever fear his subjects owe to him, that and much more he owes to God as his king. If you're studying the Bible properly, that teaches you to fear God. If you're not studying God's word every day, then it's easy to start to assume that you know God when maybe your understanding is very shallow. There are a lot of people that think they know God, but it's really just a God they've set up in their own minds after their own image. And it's no wonder they don't really fear that God. You study the Bible and you get to know the real God, the God of power and of judgment and law and love. That's what God needs in his leaders. Study every day. Get to know him so you fear him enough to obey him. Fear God to keep these words and do them. God wanted to make sure that the king ruled in the fear of God, and he did that by having him be a daily student of the law of God. Ruling in the fear of God means ruling according to the law of God. You don't just make stuff up. You study and administer the law of God. Now, God's laws prevent tyranny. A godly leader implements God's laws, and those laws are just. God's laws protect the poor and the needy, ruling in the fear of God means you're looking after those people rather than abusing them. God's laws secure private property. They make it so leaders can't just come along and take things from people. God's laws limit government. They check the power and the human nature of the leaders. Now, the more you know history and the more you compare that with the law of God, the more you realize just how unique and revolutionary and special God's laws are and how much they reflect the love of God and the wisdom of God and how altogether different they are from the laws of man. I think this is interesting. If you go on in this passage in Deuteronomy 18, it talks about another critical effect that governing according to the law of God and studying the law of God has. It says that his heart, the heart of this king, be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. But the very first thing that's mentioned there is that when a leader gets away from the law of God and lacks the fear of God, what happens? Well, his heart gets lifted up above the people. He starts thinking of himself as better than people. And that invariably leads to all kinds of abuses of power. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written a booklet years ago called God's Family Government. And this is how that booklet begins. In man's entire history, we have not found one government that will truly serve the people. This whole world is in a crisis, and the major problem is government. How true that is today. So many of these leaders, they do not serve the people, and they don't serve it because they don't keep God's law of love. When the wicked rule, the people mourn. And through history, really, there have been a lot of wicked rulers and a lot of mourning people. Historian Rodney Stark wrote a book called How the West Won. And it's really a survey of history that shows what a miracle it is and just how rare it is to live in a nation with freedom and prosperity. Very few people in history have had the kinds of advantages that we have today. He wrote in that book, most people throughout history lived lives of misery and exploitation in tyrannical empires that covered huge areas. As the centuries passed, most people lived as they always had, just a notch above barest subsistence, little better off than their oxen. And a lot of this was because of wicked leaders taking advantage of people. In all of the great ancient empires, something that was very common was something that Rodney Stark calls monumentalism. The kings and the pharaohs, they built huge statues, immense shrines, massive ziggurats, and so on. They're very impressive, but they were basically vanity projects for the rulers built on the backs of millions of poor people. Stark writes, despite such monuments and fabulous royal wealth, the great empires were very poor. You know, you would have a filthy rich emperor, but he writes, because of imperial opulence, century after century, the standard of living in China, northern India, Mesopotamia, and Egypt hovered around the threshold of pauperization. Too often, historians have noted the immense wealth of rulers without grasping the sacrifices this imposed on the populace. You know, you look at ancient Egypt and you have very impressive structures that are present even to this day. But as Stark says, peasant families always wavered between abject poverty and utter destitution. What a horror show. Stark writes, the economic system of ancient empires and of all despotic states has come to be known as the command economy, since the state commands and coerces markets and labor to exact wealth for itself rather than allowing them to function freely. The people are usually subject not only to confiscatory taxation, In other words, the government just takes whatever it wants, but also to forced labor, which accounts for the monumentalism of empires. So these leaders don't just, they don't hire workers, they just force people to build. And often they barely feed them, and a whole lot of people die as these projects are constructed. There were probably a million people who died to build the Great Wall of China, just to take one example. A million people in the construction of that edifice. Billions of people throughout history have lived under these kinds of conditions, where anything of value that someone has, whether it's land or crops or livestock or buildings, even children, those could be just arbitrarily seized. And so often the leaders didn't invest that wealth in their people. They just consumed it. And often it was just in various forms of display. Stark writes, the Egyptian pyramids, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and the Taj Mahal were all built as monuments to repressive rule. They were without productive value and were paid for by misery and want. It's exactly for that reason that God explicitly commanded his kings, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. God didn't want kings just amassing wealth at the hands of the people that they were leading. And it wasn't just to protect the king and his character. That was meant to protect the people. You can look back at these historical examples, and they may seem very extreme, but In many ways, we're moving in the same direction today. We're witnessing the problems that come from leaders who just spend whatever they want. $1.2 trillion here, $3.5 trillion there. The law might restrain them from making direct withdrawals from our bank accounts, although they're trying to get rid of those restrictions as well. But they just print the money. So all of the dollars in all of our bank accounts aren't worth as much. These leaders are just taking wealth at will for their modern monumentalism, which doesn't even produce impressive buildings. It just gets swallowed up in worthless or destructive government projects, welfare projects. God's law prevents those abuses. Ruling in the fear of God keeps that from happening. Human governments often act in their own interests. That's why they get bigger and bigger and bigger. They consume more and more of the people's resources. God's government does not do that. It acts in the people's interest because God is at the top and God is love. He's always looking out for the benefit of those he governs. History shows that property rights and personal liberty are essential for societies to prosper. You look at the example of Great Britain. This is a quote from Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations. This was written in 1776. And Adam Smith wrote, "That security which the laws of Great Britain give to every man, that he shall enjoy the fruits of his own labor, is alone sufficient to make any country flourish." Now, these are biblical concepts. These are enshrined in God's law. God wants every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and he gave laws to ensure that. Now, Stark wrote, at the time that Adam Smith was writing, French farmers actually tried to appear poor so that they wouldn't be taxed too much. And that's actually very common all through history. Most nations in history have incentivized poverty. Now, Britain, by contrast, the farmers there were much more productive, and that fed the nation well, and that improved general productivity and prosperity. Stark writes, "French farmers, for example, were less productive to the point that during the 18th century, as many as 20% of the French were so poorly fed that they couldn't do even light work for more than 3 hours a day. In the late 1700s, the average British soldier was 4 inches taller than the average French soldier." That's a very specific example of how living by godly principles works. Those soldiers were healthier. They were taller because they were healthier, because they were better fed, because farmers were able to produce without fear of the leaders just taking their land or taking their produce. It shows the tremendous advantages of every man under his vine and under his fig tree, which is secured by godly leaders. Now, this has been the case in America from the very beginning. In early America, under British common law, Stark writes, individuals had an unlimited right to property that they had legally obtained, and not even the state could abridge that right without adequate compensation. And that produced what Stark calls the American miracle. God used these Bible-based principles to bestow the birthright blessings on America and on Britain, the blessings that he had actually promised to certain of Abraham's descendants. At America's founding, its Declaration of Independence said that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, if the rights of human beings are given by God, then you'd better respect them. This is a quote from RenewAmerica.com, an author named Stanley Zier. He says, in a nutshell, our rule of law is our firm stance against tyranny. The intensity with which our Constitution was created with the sole purpose to prevent and block tyranny can only have been divinely inspired and manifested through our founding fathers. Without the Ten Commandments, the underpinnings of moral advancement in humanity, we would not have had the ethical imperative that produced the laws that framed our Constitution, without which the ideals that our republic adheres to could never have been actualized. Now, it really is profound. It's easy to take these things for granted until you see what is happening now, when the whole system is being overturned and dismantled and our rights are being stripped at just unprecedented speed. But it does make you appreciate the law of God. It makes you appreciate the freedoms enshrined in the law of God and those freedoms that are preserved under righteous leadership. At one point during Jesus Christ's ministry, his disciples were arguing about what kind of honor and privilege they would receive. They wanted to get high offices. And Christ took the opportunity to teach about godly leadership. He called his disciples together and he said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, lordship over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. The examples of this fill the history books, and they are everywhere in the world today. Rulers routinely exercise authority arbitrarily. Justice is inconsistent or non-existent. Look at China. You have a lot of people that refer to Xi Jinping as the president of China. He commands 1.5 billion people, almost one out of every five people in the entire world. And the name president makes it sound like he wins elections and he governs a republic. No, he is a dictator who's changing China's constitution so he can rule indefinitely. And he has many titles, this man: General Secretary of the Communist Party, Chairman of the Central Military Commission, Corps Leader, Paramount Leader. I think it's interesting. Barack Obama, at one point, he said that he thought it was a beautiful thing how Chinese leaders can act without concern for votes. When you're the president of China, quote unquote, you can do whatever you want. You don't have to deal with elections. You don't have to negotiate your budget with congressmen you don't like. You're accountable to nobody, not even God. And that is the kind of leadership that most people throughout history have lived under. And some of the most extreme examples have been in atheistic communist nations. Former communist Whitaker Chambers said, the communist vision is the vision of man without God. It is the vision of man's mind displacing God as the creative intelligence of the world. So when someone in power thinks that way, then whatever problems they see, they alone can solve them. They alone have the answers. And what disasters that produces when a man doesn't believe there's any authority higher than himself. U.S. President John Adams said, "Power always thinks it has a great soul and vast views beyond the comprehension of the weak, and that it is doing God's service when it is violating all his laws." But Jesus Christ told his disciples, "It shall not be so among you." God's approach to leadership is radically different. A godly leader needs to be like Solomon, who bowed before God. He said very humbly, "Who am I to rule so great a people?" He just asked God to direct every one of his steps. Whoever we are ruling over, wife, children, students, employees, they're God's. And we're accountable before him and have to govern by his law of love. Jesus said, "Whosoever will be great among you, let him be your servant. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your bondslave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." That's how Jesus Christ used authority. And that's what he expects from us. "He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." When a leader does that, it is an incomparable blessing. The government of God is an immeasurable blessing. It makes people rejoice. Proverbs 22 and verse 4 says, "By humility and the fear of the eternal are riches and honor and life." And we see a lot of people in this world seeking riches and honor in life in some other way. We see leaders who are stealing these things from the people that they're meant to be serving. And what curses and problems that produces. Now, we all have human nature, and we're all susceptible to making those mistakes because we're all susceptible to Satan's influence. But God makes clear how to protect ourselves from that. And this proverb spells it out explicitly. "By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life." James 4 says, "Submit yourselves to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up." If you want to be a godly leader, that's where it has to start. If you want to be lifted up, this is the fundamental quality you need. This is the quality that is lacking in the leaders of this world. And this is the quality that we need to develop if we want to qualify to replace them. "He that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Mihailo Zekic, my guest today, and thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Folt for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Abraham Lincoln. "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.